You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 3rd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alan Collins on the case for canceling student loan debt. Then, Elliot Harmon, senior activist of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, on the question of Section 230. Meanwhile, the CDC warns that the next 3 months will likely be the most difficult in public health history of this nation. As yesterday records near 3,000 deaths in this country from COVID. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer push for a $900 billion COVID relief bill as unemployment continues unabated. Mitch McConnell balks. President of the United States, Donald Trump, increasingly unglued as Mike Pence slowly, quietly walks away. And with polls virtually tied in both Georgia runoff elections, Donald Trump heads to Georgia amongst a swamp of conspiracies. More than 40 states line up for a possible antitrust suit versus Facebook. Questions arise over Joe Biden's aggressive fundraising for what everyone expects to be a virtual inauguration. Obviously, a virtual non-inauguration, practically. Ron, foreign minister, signals a willingness for broader deals with the U.S. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma is out for the day. She is moving. So thank you for joining us. It has been quite a day for the president gave a 45-minute speech yesterday. I'm not going to lie. I did not watch the whole thing. The first 2 minutes is really,
it may have been his most important speech of all time.
So. I mean, according to him, it was the most important speech of all time that he ever gave. And, I guess my reaction was, I don't know that I believe that. And so I did not watch it. I frankly don't know that there was ever an important speech that he gave, to be honest, because there was very little that he would say that had any direct bearing upon what he would do. Anyway.
I would elect the speech he gave at the convention when there was all this talk of them wanting to throw him overboard for another one of the establishment Republicans. And he came out on the first night unplanned and introduced Melania. I think that's his most important speech because he's like, I'm the daddy now.
He cemented it. I mean, I think there's some truth to that. And, but nevertheless, he was convinced it was the most important speech ever. There is an interesting dynamic that is building right now. There was a poll that came out by a Survey USA in conjunction with local Channel 11, I believe it was, in Atlanta. And they found that the races between Ossoff and Perdue and Warnock and Loeffler are almost virtually tied, or virtually tied. I mean, the Ossoff race, he is up by 2 points, but that was is in within the margin of error. So essentially, he is at 50%, Perdue is at 48%, essentially tied. Warnock has a small advantage over Loeffler, 52 to 45%. Again, there's a there's a margin of error there, but it appears that he has a slight lead. She has unleashed a barrage of negative ads, digging through apparently his decades of being a minister. That is all part of the politics. But what's fascinating is the turmoil that is going on the Republican side surrounding Sidney Powell, and the was never a lawyer for the Trump candidate campaign, apparently a person who was also seemingly the lawyer for the Trump campaign's attempt to overthrow the decision of the voters. She is there. She held a rally. And much of the rally was an attack on Georgian government officials, essentially saying that they are all in some way cheating Donald Trump and presumably Donald Trump's lawyers. Here is a clip of a man named Lynn Wood who is at the, rally. He, and here's what he's saying at this rally.
I want you to go to the governor's mansion. I want you to circle it. I want you to blow your horns until Brian Kemp comes out and orders a special session of the Georgia legislature. Get us our legislature and tell everybody we want our legislator to meet and we want him to fix the mess that he created. And then he can resign. And then, as far as I'm concerned, lock him up.
Let's take a play clip number six, where this attorney, Lynn Wood, who is on the podium, gets very explicit about what these presumably Republican voters should do.
Are more alike than we are different. But I'm going to disagree with Vernon Jones. Where is Kelly Loeffler here? Where is David Perdue? He ought to be standing right here. Those two people want your vote, then they ought to tell you what we're telling Brian Kemp. Get a special session of the legislature now. Do not be fooled twice. This is Georgia. We ain't dumb. We're not going to go vote on January 5th in another machine made by China. You're not going to fool Georgians again. If Kelly Loeffler wants your vote, if David Perdue wants your vote, they've got to earn it. They've got to demand publicly, repeatedly, consistently, Brian Kemp call a special session of the Georgia legislature. And if they do not do it, if Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue do not do it, they have not earned your vote. Don't you give it to them. Why would you go back and vote in another rigged election? For God's sakes, fix it. You got
Now, on stage there, you can see Sidney Powell behind him. Sidney Powell, again, the not Trump campaign lawyer who has been basically pretending for an extended period of time that she was the campaign lawyer. Vernon Jones, who is a Democrat, a congressperson from, a Georgia state representative, a member of the Democratic Party, but has been a vocal Trump supporter. He's on stage there. There may have been others, but that, you know, I don't know how many people were in that rally. But you can hear Lynn Wood sitting there and basically saying, don't vote unless Loeffler and Perdue and Kemp do all of these sort of, I don't know, these the specific measures to fix the voting there. Now, Lynn Wood apparently is also the lawyer, if I'm not mistaken, for this the kid Rittenhouse who killed three people.
Yeah, he's one of them.
He's one of the lawyers. Now, there's also some controversy over like who this guy is. Breitbart is insisting that he's some type of like Democratic plant. He apparently has donated to Democrats in the past. It's unclear. Obviously, he was invited onto the stage. He is part of this sort of movement. He's been a vocal Trump supporter for some time. But it occurs to me that, you know, if I was the Democratic Party, I would certainly hope that I would have people at that rally saying that type of thing to them to you know, I guess create a little bit of turmoil within the Republican Party voters in Georgia. But it's a fascinating thing, and the Republican Party is just like sitting with bated breath, waiting to see what Donald Trump is going to do when he goes to Georgia on Saturday. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alan Collins. Although we've got one more minute. Let's play this then. Let's play this clip of Sidney Powell. She is explaining. Now understand that there has been $170 million at least raised by the Trumps. I mean, the campaign's over, by the Trumps. At least 75% of which has gone into Donald Trump's new PAC, which presumably is going to fly him around the country for 4 years. The other 25% presumably went to the RNC in their attempts to overturn this election. Sidney Powell apparently has some money in her account from all this and is just keeping her powder dry with the cash. Here she is.
Thank you all so much for caring enough to be here today.
Yeah, us.
Pause this for a second. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of people there. Do we have any numbers on this?
I haven't seen any, but it does sound like a lot.
It sounds like a lot of people. It also sounds like, you know, they're pretty close to each other. Continue.
It is my honor, and I know it, Lynn feels like it's his honor, and so does the rest of our significant team who have been working day and night since the election, none of whom have been paid a dime yet, although we do, people have been generating, have been contributing generously to defendingtherepublic.org, but we haven't even had time to get the stuff set up to write a check to pay anybody with yet. We're too busy fighting the fight, but...
to pay it.
Thank you. I know you have my six, and we all really appreciate that. Once again, you inspire us. God bless you, and God bless America.
Yeah, there it is. Well, I mean, she's been doing this work pro bono. So, and here is, wow, that is the reverse angle. Now, it's, you know, it's a tough, you know, type of lens, but those people seem awful, awful close. And I'm trying to see if there was any mask there. It does not look like there were many.
No.
Which is not. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Venn diagram that includes people who are convinced that there was a server in Germany that has been essentially, attacked by U.S. forces to get the data from the vote in Georgia. I'm going to say the folks who believe that and the folks who believe that they should wear a mask or they shouldn't wear a mask because of COVID. I think there's probably quite an overlap there in that crowd in terms of those Venn diagrams. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alan Collins. He's the founder of Student Loan Justice. We'll be back in just a sec. And this is, I just want to give a reminder to folks, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, we've got merch. Check out our merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Great stuff for the holidays. Have we even rolled out the beanie yet? We haven't, right? I keep like teasing.
Waiting on final design approval.
I gave final design approval. Didn't I?
No, from Soros.
Okay, well.
The big man.
Let's just do this. Let's get it up there. But folks, check it out. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. And also the AM Quickie. You can check that out every day. And, later today at 3 p.m., Nomi's on Nomi's show. We have, Harvey Kay, Representative Chris Robb, and Arun Chaudhary will be on with Nomi at 3 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. You can check that out. All right. Let's bring Alan on if we have him. I'd like to welcome to the program Alan Collins. He is the founder of Student Loan Justice. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's great to be with you, Sam.
Alan, will you just let us know your website again so that people can get more information?
Oh, sure. It's studentloanjustice.org.
Okay, there you go. All right, so let's just start with, if we could, can you give us just some of the sort of the basic numbers around student loans? Where are we at this point in terms of the size of the debt?
Well, officially, we're at $1.6 trillion for federal student loans and another 10% or so on private loans. But, you know, there's a lot of interest baked into the real number that's not included in the official figure. My best estimate is that we're over $2 trillion now. And where, say, in 2004, the average undergraduate was leaving college with maybe $12,000 in loans. Today, it's closer to $40,000 in loans if you include both student loans and also a new sort of relatively new type of loan called Parent Plus loans. So people for an undergraduate degree, people and their families are taking out $40,000 or more.
What percentage do you know, if you know, what percentage of those loans are for for-profit colleges or universities?
Well, pound for pound, for-profit colleges get about 90% or more of their revenue from student loans. I don't know what the breakdown is. Roughly, I'd say maybe 10% or so.
Okay.
It's a minority. The for-profit colleges are just horrible, though, if I could say.
Well, yes. I mean, we've spoken about this many times. And during the Obama administration, there was a lot of crackdown on these enterprises. And I've mentioned in the past many times, you can go back and you can look at any type of fund that would have for-profit university stocks. And you can see on literally the day after the election of Donald Trump, these things took off like a rocket, straight up. But I'm aware that, you know, the entire business model essentially for these for-profit universities is to get government loans. But they so if I understand you correctly, they only represent about 10% of that overall debt.
Yeah, maybe a bit more. It's not a huge amount. But pound for pound, it's more than other colleges, because as you said, they get 90% of their revenue from student loans. You know, they've recruited at homeless shelters in the past, anything to get a warm body in the seat, really. And by the way, they spend more money on advertising than they do on actually educating people. So that
Yeah, the people can go back. We've had several interviews about this. I think it was over the years we've talked about this, and I suspect we'll talk about it more because I have a feeling that the Biden administration is going to crack down on that a bit. But what percent of let's just stick with the official figures for now, and then you know if we want to give us a sense of why you think that money might be those numbers might be higher. But of the official figures, would about $1.7 trillion, I guess. What percent of that money is principal versus accrued interest? Like how much?
Well, that
1.7 was actually borrowed.
That is a great and important question that nobody, not even the Department of Education, knows the answer to, unfortunately. So loans are bought and sold and consolidated and defaulted and rehabilitated, and interest is capitalized into the principal and so forth. So really, nobody knows what that number is. But if you look at government lending over time, so $100 billion per year, and you look at the growth in the loan balance, and if you look at certain parts of the lending system, like the older FFELP legacy loans, and you look at how that decreases over time, you can sort of back out a pretty rough estimate. And my best estimate is that less than a third, perhaps far less than a third, of that $1.6 or $7 trillion is actual original principal. And by the way, it's pretty important also to note that since 2010, the federal government has been booking a profit on this lending system of not insignificant proportions. We're talking $50 billion in 2012.
I want to get to the profits. And sure. That is a sort of there's some controversy, it seems to me, around that. I mean, obviously, there's controversy at least around all of this, because if we can't actually say how much of that money was principal and how much of it was interest, we can't even say how much this is going to actually cost the taxpayers, right? Because it's really not a cost to the taxpayers to say that we did not realize the gains that we would have gotten from interest. If we're talking about, you know, if the actual principal that was loaned out with tax dollars was, let's say, $800 billion, $600 billion, you can't, you know, you could say theoretically that money would have been invested in some other socially good purposes and whatnot. But it's stunning in a way that we don't have a hard figure for how much of this $1.7 trillion isn't just like compounded interest.
That's exactly right, Sam. And you know, the cost debate, and you hit on a critical issue. There are a lot of, I call them sort of student loan swamp people. So unelected bureaucrats, lobbyists, other people benefiting from the federal loan program. And they are working overtime to pervert the cost story. So in other words, when you ask them about cost, they'll say, oh, no, the government's not profiting on loans. In fact, they're losing money, and they use all these really perverted costing models. For example, they call something fair value modeling, which in itself is a very fair way to assess the cost of a lending program or other asset. But what they do, and when I say they, I mean people like the Congressional Budget Office under the Republicans, many other sort of swamp minions, Jason Delisle, I could throw some names out. But they are trying very hard to make it look like the federal government is actually losing money on the program rather than making it, and making a lot of it. And that's a very important point. But I feel pretty solid, Sam, that truly unpaid principal is a very small portion of that federal portfolio. It's certainly less than a third. I typically tend to be pretty conservative in my estimates.
Okay. Well, so let's move on to that question about whether the U.S. government makes money off of these loans. What is the argument that they do not, if you could characterize that argument for us?
Sure. So number one, people like to claim, people will claim all day long that, oh, we're going to be forgiving all these loans through the public service loan forgiveness program, through the income-based repayment program and other income contingent repayment programs where after a certain amount of time, the loans are canceled or forgiven. And number two, they'll say, oh, the government's really not making any money on this because by this fair value lending model, you know, if we had used this money to make, say, private student loans, which are at a higher interest rate, then clearly we're losing money and a lot of it on this lending program. But, you know, that just flies in the face of rationality and reason, Sam. In real money terms, the government not only makes something like 6-7% in profit on the portfolio, but many years of White House budget data confirm that even on defaulted loans, the federal government gets back more than it pays out on defaulted loans. So in that case, really all the costing models get blown out of the water. Because if you can't lose money on defaulted loans overall, and the Department of Education does not, it's pretty much impossible to lose money on the program. So, okay, and so also on.
Yeah. If I understand you, let me just stop there. So if I understand sure. what you're saying, when we hear people say the government loses money on these loans, what they're saying is that there's an opportunity cost for having lent this money out at these rates with these default rates, as opposed to other things that we theoretically could have done with the money.
That's right. It's kind of like if Exxon was to point to a guy selling biodiesel in his garage for like $8 a gallon and say, look at that guy. This guy is selling his gas for $8 a gallon. We only sell ours for like $2 a gallon. So therefore, we Exxon are actually losing $6 for every gallon of gas that we sell. That is the charade that's going on here with this so-called fair value cost modeling.
I understand. Okay. And so in terms of the question of defaulted loans, when you say that there's data that suggests that the U.S. government is making money off of defaulted loans, correct me if I'm wrong, if I understand what you're saying, the government loans out, let's just say hypothetically, $1,000. The interest over the course of the loan is maybe $2,000 or $3,000 over the course of that. The government recoups $1,000, maybe recoups another $250 or $500, so $1,500. And then the loan is defaulted upon. And that is the way in which you have – that's the way that you make money on loans that have defaulted.
In other words, that's right. Okay. They don't make a killing on defaulted loans, but they don't lose money. You know, a credit card company is thrilled to get back 5-10 cents on the dollar on a defaulted loan, and so too for every other loan, government or private in the United States. But if you go to the White House budget going back decades now at this point, you look at the Appendix 4 supplementary materials, you will see in all the world of government guaranteed and government made loans, only student loans return more than a dollar on the dollar for defaulted loans. It's really an incredible piece of data that nobody talks about nearly enough.
Why do you think that is? Is that because it is so difficult to default on a student loan?
Well, it's because in the absence of bankruptcy protections, which every other loan has, in the absence of statutes of limitations, which every other loan has, the government has apparently found a way to get blood from a stone. And I should say this comes at a massive social cost. You know, people are hounded for the rest of their lives. Senior citizens are losing their social security income. People are having their wages garnished literally for the rest of their lives. And what the government gets back doesn't even cover principal or fees. It doesn't even cover interest in most cases.
All right,
so
well, I want to go through this. Give us a sense of how student loans are, and you've touched on it a little bit, but give us a more specific sense. How are student loans less protected, let's say, than any other type of loan, whether it's a mortgage or whether it's a home equity or a business loan or even credit card,
sure.
Give us a sense of just what protections are there for every other type of loan or most loans and are not there for student loans.
Well, you know, Sam, I'm actually hard pressed at this point to name a consumer protection that actually exists, certainly for federal student loans. I mentioned bankruptcy, the big two of bankruptcy protections, statutes of limitations are gone for all intents and purposes. But also fair debt collection practices are greatly restricted. Truth in lending laws are gone. And these are federal loans that we're talking about. Even state usury laws have been taken off the table for federal student loans. So really, I'm trying to think of a consumer protection that actually exists for federal student loans, and I can't really think of one off the top of my head. I mean, this is the wholesale removal of protections, including bankruptcy, which the founding fathers, by the way, called for ahead of the power to raise an army and declare war in the Constitution. So this lending system is weaponized against the citizens and has been since arguably the mid-70s and beyond.
What was the rationale for this? I mean, I know what was the rationale behind, making student loans non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, for instance?
Yeah, there was never a good rationale, Sam. I think there was greed. But what happened was the student loan industry, Sallie Mae was a pretty young organization at that point, but people who had a profit interest in this lending program, they seeded stories in the media about law school students, doctors, lawyers, others fleeing from graduation straight to bankruptcy court and discharging their loans. And the media was sort of a Twitter about it. And lo and behold, they started restricting bankruptcy protections, first putting on a 5-year waiting period, then extending that 5 years to 7 years. And then ultimately in 1998, they took off all time limits. And so by 1998, bankruptcy was completely gone from federal student loans. But you know, Sam, we now know in hindsight that back when student loans were treated precisely the same as all other consumer debt in bankruptcy proceedings, less than 1%, like a third of 1%, wound up being discharged in bankruptcy. That's lower than other categories of debt. So there was never a crisis, in the words of one congressman at the time. He said this was a crisis only in the imagination.
And if I understand you, when you say there are people who are directly profiting, I mean, obviously, like if I'm a congressperson, I'm not necessarily I'm not profiting, obviously, from student loan debt. But the idea was that there's private student loans, and they were looking for these protections, and the easiest way to deal with that was to sort of extend it to everything. Is that what was going on?
Yeah, that's right. Back in the older days and up until 2010, private banks and these sort of hybrid corporations like Sallie Mae, which actually had people from the federal government on their board, but yet still they could make a profit. They owned the loans and the government guaranteed the loans, so protected against default, paid the lenders in the case of default, etc. So they had carte blanche to make money on these loans, and they also had this government guarantee that made them essentially risk-free. But they saw an opportunity, and taking bankruptcy protections away under the – I suppose if you want to say there was a rationale, I guess maybe the government involvement in the loans was sort of a very weak rationale. So there was always a profit motive in this lending system. And now today that the loans are federalized under Obama, even still all the same big guys that were making a ton of money last decade, they are still making a ton of money. They don't own the loans anymore, but they still service the loans and they still collect on defaulted loans. And that is the key there. Because you can take a defaulted $100,000 defaulted loan and you can turn that into a $200,000+ defaulted loan. And in the absence of all those consumer protections that we mentioned, and in the presence of just draconian collection powers that no other lending industry has, it's really like taking candy from a baby. They've got fish over a barrel.
Let me just clarify that. So I default to my $100,000 loan. In other words, I stop paying the loan.
Right.
The cost of that loan continues to accrue, right? I mean, the interest accrues and I get more penalties and fees. There are no safeguards as to how I can function as a debt collector or a debt, my loan collection agency. And I continue to hammer. And at various times, I find ways of garnishing this person's wages. I find maybe a garnishment of their Social Security if they're getting some, maybe other government benefits that they might have. That's what you're saying in terms of how this continues to be profitable even when the loan is defaulted.
That's exactly right. So, certainly some people fall off the grid and change their name and move to Mexico or whatever the case may be and never pay anything. But there's clearly a lot of people who come into a financial windfall, inherit money, have their Social Security, even disability income garnished, et cetera, wages garnished. So on balance, the government actually is making a little bit of a profit on these defaults. By the way, this is very rarely reported, but I urge your listeners to go to the White House budget, look at the supplementary materials, look at the recovery rates in Appendix 4, and it's unambiguous.
Well, it's fascinating because much of this, frankly, this was obviously heavily implicated in the primaries, the Democratic primaries. Joe Biden was very much involved in a lot of this bankruptcy reform, as it were. Elizabeth Warren entered into politics in many respects because of some of those so-called reforms. Lastly, give us a sense of just like, to what extent, how hard would it be to cancel all this? And then what do you do going forward? I mean, if you cancel the debt, like, obviously you don't want to continue on with the same system that is creating basically indentured servants in some respect.
Yeah, this can't continue. And we are now at the point where this lending system is in catastrophic failure. 80% of all borrowers were never going to be able to repay their loans, even before the pandemic. So the default rate for 2004 students is 40%. And they were only borrowing a third as much as is being borrowed today. So by all rational metrics, the lending system it's done. It's, the subprime home mortgage default rate was 18%. And we are looking at 75 or 80% now. So the loans have got to go away. And the easiest way, thankfully, at least for federal student loans, is by executive order. So the Department of Education, the secretary, and by extension, the president, it turns out they can cancel loans. They can waive, release, compromise their interest in a very broad way. The president, in fact, President Trump today could order the secretary to cancel all federal loans, and it would happen. There would be controversy, certainly, but it can happen, and we've been calling for exactly that since March. We started a petition, change.org/cancel student loans. We've got nearly a million signatures now. But it turns out that this is a very efficient way to cancel loans. There's nothing to be paid for. You don't need to raise additional tax monies. The taxpayers already paid for these loans many years ago, and they didn't pay much. And this adds nothing to the national debt. And so there's really, in my view, there's no better, easier, better targeted and or cheaper way to stimulate the economy right now than by literally ending this lending system and coming up with something more fair, more rational, more rationally priced going forward.
Alan College, founder of Student Loan Justice at studentloanjustice.org?
Yep.
I can find you there. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Now I think we have Elliot Harmon coming up next. We have him. Elliot Harmon, he is the senior activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we're talking about something that I think people are going to be hearing a lot more of. Right now, Donald Trump has said that he will not sign the defense authorization bill unless Section 230 is struck from the Digital Millennium Act And so I think we're going to hear a lot more about this going forward, regardless of who controls the Senate, frankly, starting in January. Elliot, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming. Tell us what Section 230 is and when was it created?
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on, Sam. I'm really excited to be here. Section 230, there's actually a little bit of a misconception. It was passed as part of the CDA, the Communications Decency Act, in 1996, and not the DMCA, though it's sometimes worth talking about both laws together. Section 230, to put it just very succinctly, it says that if you go on the internet and you say something unlawful, you're the one who should be held responsible. You're the one who should be liable, not the website where you said it and not any other party. There has been a bit of a misconception.
Unlawful. What constitutes something unlawful? I mean, so something, if I libel, in writing, or I slander somebody on on this program, let's say, what else would constitute unlawful?
Right. You're right on the first one, that many, many of the cases that involve Section 230 are, libel or defamation cases. There's also, certainly material related to obscenity laws, relating to sex work. And we can have a whole discussion about the one time that Congress changed Section 230 and put sex workers in a great deal of danger. There are, lots of laws that implicate speech in one way or another. And again, what Section 230 says, or what it does, is it says that you are the one responsible for those posts. You're the one who will be held liable in court, not the app that you use to post it, not the website where you posted it. One of the ways that there's been so much misinformation, and that Trump himself has been the source of a lot of that misinformation, is saying that Section 230 is some kind of handout to big tech or to Silicon Valley. Section 230 protects all of us. If you've ever forwarded an email, if a court decides that email is defamatory, then Section 230 says that you can't be held liable for it.
I see. Okay. So, it has been a gift to big tech in some respects, right? I mean, it's not a unilateral one. And at the time that it was developed, it wasn't necessarily, it has been one of the mechanisms that has allowed these platforms to grow. And so let's talk about how we deal with, some of the problems that we have with these platforms, right? And we're talking about Facebook, we're talking about Google, to some extent we're talking about Amazon and all their subsidiary companies. From your perspective, what do people see as the problem?
It's interesting. There's been kind of these two parallel discourses going on about Section 230. On the one hand, you have people, primarily people on the right, saying that the problem is that Twitter and Facebook are censoring people, and in particular this idea that they're primarily censoring conservatives, which, as far as I can tell, is a claim without a whole lot of evidence to back it up, and that the platforms need to be quote-unquote neutral public forums. There's even this myth that somehow you need to be a neutral public forum, or you need to be unbiased in order to have Section 230 protections, and that's not true. At the very same time, there's this other discourse that I'd say is kind of primarily people on the left saying that platforms aren't doing enough to remove disinformation, to remove hate speech, and saying that Section 230 should be changed somehow to say that you only get Section 230 protections if you meet these certain criteria for removing that kind of problematic material. The irony is that on both sides, there's this little nugget of truth that it is a genuine problem that there are only, depending how you count, four or five companies that control so much of speech on the internet, such that the moderation decisions that one of them makes will have massive reverberations in terms of who's allowed to speak and who's allowed to organize online and what messages get out there. That's a genuine problem. Unfortunately, people have latched on to 230 as the vehicle to use to address that problem, when at least all of the evidence that we have so far shows that undermining 230 or completely repealing 230, as Trump claims to want, will give the big tech companies more power. I mentioned a second ago, Sesta Foster.
I want to walk through this because this is important for people to understand. The argument that that let's say you hear from the conservatives, like I've been shadow banned, or I'm not allowed to find out the real truth of the server in Germany that has been, taken by an elite squad of American military personnel, and they're going to deliver it to Governor Kemp in Georgia. I can't say that as if it was, as if it was something, on my Facebook thing, that channel that gave me that information is no longer, operating. The argument there is that these platforms have become so important and integral to our daily lives that they are essentially functioning like a utility, like the electric company, like the idea of phone lines. And therefore, they cannot make those distinctions in any more than, the phone company can decide what I say on the phone to somebody else or in a conference call or something to that effect. That is one of the issue there for that type of censorship. And then the other, of course, is you're a public utility. You have a responsibility to differentiate between these things in the same way that like the FCC regulates, broadcast television and says like, there's certain limitations as to what you can do here. Some people argue that we should nationalize these platforms, which I think is very problematic because then you have the government in there deciding, what these standards are. And that's very complicated. I certainly wouldn't want Donald Trump's FCC to be in charge of whatever agency it would be as to what, Twitter can put out there. So then the question is like, how do we deal with this stuff? And your argument is that, to focus on 230 is looking at the wrong thing. Well, so what would happen if we got rid of 230 in terms of these things?
It's funny. There's this idea that's developed that if we got rid of Section 230, then suddenly platforms would become a lot more hands off in their moderation decisions. It's a little bit hard to tell what would happen because all of these companies that we're talking about were founded well after 230 passed. But from the evidence that we have, at least thus far, the opposite would happen. They would need to become much more restrictive in what they allow online and in, frankly, who they allow online.
All of a sudden, if somebody's going to write on Twitter, I mean, I guess I'm a public figure, but if someone was going to write something like, boy, I watched the Majority Report today, and that Alien Harmon, he looks like a blankety blank, and he accused you of something. You could sue whoever, on that platform, theoretically, in which someone wrote that, right?
I mean, right. It's important to sorry, go ahead.
No, well, go ahead.
And it's important to think about that from the perspective of the platforms. The question for them would not be, would we be able to fight off a defamation suit in court? The question would be, will that defamation suit happen in the first place? What 230 essentially does is it gives platforms and other kind of intermediaries too flexibilities to sort of define their own moderation policies. And I think personally, it's a good thing for the internet to have some platforms that are more restrictive and some that are more hands off. I think it's good to have that multiplicity of choices. But when platforms are essentially forced to put their thumb on the scale, forced to put anything that is in a gray area into the delete pile, who's affected by that is not uniform across everyone. The people who would be removed from the discussion first would be marginalized voices.
Of course. That's always the case in any dynamic, right? I mean, it's always the people with the least amount of political or economic power who are going to be the first, who are going to lose in that situation. All right. Well, so let me bounce this off you. So, I mean, and I think, you know, we talk a lot about antitrust on this, program. And if the solution is not to be able to like effectively, moderate these things or to come up with the perfect special sauce as to what things should be allowed and whatnot, the only other solution is to make these platforms not as so crucial to be a part of if you want to communicate, it seems to me, from my perspective. Instead of like, you know, the world can still exist if Facebook isn't the place that everybody goes to. There could be five other Facebooks. And so that, you know, you can go to the one that you're a little bit more suited to. We already, you know, are in our own silos on these things anyways. So the idea that multiple ones would exist. Let me bounce this idea off you. I mean, there's multiple ways in which antitrust can be applied to these things. And usually has to do with separating the data of the users and the ability to sell that data or sell against that data, right? And sell advertising. We'll have about 4 or 5 minutes here. So I want to bounce this idea off you. What if there was no algorithm? What if, I mean, could we under an antitrust, let's say, paradigm, could we say one of the things that we won't allow is an algorithm that feeds you content, right? Because the argument is that these things are platforms, not publishers. That's why they don't have the liability, because they're not actually publishing this content. They're just providing a platform for other people to publish it. But what does a publisher do? It seems to me makes editorial decisions. And the algorithm which pushes you content is basically an automated editor, isn't it? It's saying, this is the stuff that we're going to promote. This is how we're going to aggregate it for you, the user. Could you eliminate that algorithm so that everything is just swimming out there?
You know, it's funny. Whenever somebody proposes something like that, I always want to say, like, really? Are you sure you want an internet in which everything is swimming out there? You know, everybody who exists on Twitter has the experience of getting some weird spam message in your DMs or getting some message that is purporting to be from a real person, but is actually some kind of porn advertisement. I get one of those almost every day. And consider that that's just the tip of the iceberg. Those are just the ones that are getting through the filter currently.
Well, there's a difference between a filter and an algorithm that pushes stuff, right? I mean, like I watch something on YouTube. YouTube is going to be pushing me content. And that's different from filtering out stuff that may be spam. And they're filtering me content because that's also going to make me a riper, commodity for their sales.
Now you're, in my opinion, hitting on like one of the really important points here is that when we're thinking about how to deal with the lack of competition in social media platforms, one, we frankly need some updates to antitrust law. One of the kind of limitations of antitrust law right now is that sort of the primary way that it contemplates consumer harm is price. And price isn't really what we're talking about when we're talking about the lack of competition in these platforms. We're talking about privacy. We're talking about, you know, to take the current example of the Google Fitbit merger, we're talking about a company that exists by turning your data into advertising, suddenly being able to collate your data about your online behavior with your data about offline behavior, which brings a cost to consumers that doesn't necessarily just boil down to price.
Yes, and I have to say, on behalf of the many people we've had on to talk about antitrust, we don't need a change in the laws. We just simply need a different a return to the way that we applied these laws prior to the 70s and the sort of Borkian shift that took place under Reagan. So we don't need actual change to laws. We just need an attorney general and a Department of Justice that decides to apply the laws in the way that they were originally applied prior to the changes in disposition under the Reagan administration. I should just say that. I mean, that's
okay. Fair point. To your point about privacy, I also think that we need to think about more serious privacy legislation, kind of in concert with the antitrust discussion. And this is, in my opinion, where the rubber really hits the road. Facebook endorsed Sesta Fosta. Facebook is already signaling a kind of pre-endorsement of future changes to Section 230. Facebook and Twitter and Google will be the beneficiaries of future attempts to undermine Section 230, but you're not going to hear them endorse the kind of privacy-protecting legislation that, that EFF endorses, where if they break the rules, then you have a private right of action. You can actually sue them and take them to court. You're not going to hear Facebook endorse that.
Right, Elliot, we've got about 30 seconds. What does Facebook think? They have a competitive advantage if 230 is applied, because they'll have the ability to moderate, stuff in a way that competitors won't. Why do they support it?
Right, because Facebook has, you know, these gigantic staffs of people doing content moderation. They have the filters and algorithms and all of that stuff. They also have the legal cushion, right? Whenever something gets proposed, like, oh, what if we passed a bill that requires platforms to do such and such? There's a whole bunch of ways that that law is going to need to be tested in court, and a startup is not going to have the budget to do it. Mm-hmm. I always point out, one, that Facebook endorsed Sesta, and two, right after Sesta passed, when multiple dating sites shut down, I think it was literally 3 weeks later, Facebook announced that it was starting a dating app.
There you go. Well, Elliot, I appreciate it. Folks can find out more by going to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. That's it for the program today. Reminder, you can, if you missed any part of this program, you can see it on the Peacock app. You can check out The Choice. You play at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. every day and then runs through the night. All right. We will see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are sticking around for the fun half, do so. Old Matt will be here. New Matt will be here. Jamie will be here. And Brendan will be here. You guys don't have like adjectives. I'm sorry, Brendan. I'm sorry, Jamie.
That's all right.
Just good Jamie, good Brendan. How's that?
That's perfect.
If like we are pilgrims or something.
What's that?
Isn't that like a Puritan thing or something? Like Goodman? Yeah. Goodman Brandon.
Goodman Brandon.
Jamie. Goodly.
Do we have Jamie? Is she here?
They haven't joined yet. Let's see if we can get them on.
Just a reminder, Nomi Show starts at 3 p.m. after this show every day. You can check out youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Joining us now, I see old Matt coming into the thing. New Matt, tell us what's been happening on Left Reckoning.
Yeah, Left Reckoning, folks. David Griscom and I's new venture. It's both on Twitch and on YouTube. David and I did our first Think Tank stream on Tuesday, and so you can check that out. That's on repeat. And I'll be in charge of the Twitch. So go subscribe if you folks that are watching on Twitch. Go subscribe to Left Reckoning on Twitch, because I think I'm going to stream maybe after the show tomorrow, and I'm going to try to steal the raid from Majority Report. So sorry, Mike from PA. But anyway, yeah, Left Reckoning on Twitch.
Ooh, controversy. Old Matt, what's up?
I'm
Undoomed.
Undoomed tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, live at youtube.com/MattBinder. Rachel Greenspan of Insider will join the show to discuss her look into how QAnon spread within the yoga and wellness communities. That's sort of how QAnon has went from, you know, right-wing fringe movement to now your, you know, your aunt, uncle, maybe even mom and dad are sharing Q drops on Facebook. So we'll get into how that happened and what that means for the future of these right-wing conspiracies tonight. YouTube.com/MattBinder, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Subscribe now.
Is Q like what, like how Georgia, how like vote stealing, like where is Q on all this? I mean, if
well, we don't
QE, but it doesn't seem as explicit. Like I'm not seeing like a bunch of Q posters, you know, around these things.
Right. The conspiracies are definitely being spread by QAnon believers. But as for what Q thinks, we don't know because Q hasn't posted in something like 20 something days.
What?
Yeah. Whoever's running that account is currently huddled with, I don't know, his conspiratorial buddies and maybe the other people who help him run that, him or her, I should say, run that account. And they're trying to figure out, I guess, where to go from here. Because right now, the QAnon people are all left on their own. And they're spinning it as, you know, Q is doing this on purpose to test us, to see if we can carry on without, you know, they find ways to explain why he's not, or she is not, dropping his communiques right now. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see what Q thinks.
Thank you. It could be a lady conspiracy theorist. I appreciate that.
Of course.
It could be. Equal opportunities over on 8kun, you know?
it could just be Sydney Powell and she's really busy.
That's right.
Right.
She doesn't even have time to get her write herself a check. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we had a little programming change. So this is running this week now. It's actually out now. We talk with Aaron Beninov about his new book, Automation and the Future of Work. He studied under Robert Brenner at UCLA, and he's very much an advocate of the Brenner thesis for exactly why things are so messed up in our economy following the neoliberal turn of the 1970s. He's got a really compelling explanation for why the demand for labor is dropping worldwide. It has more to do with economic stagnation than it does automation and productivity growth. We had a really good talk with Aaron, so check it out, patreon.com/theantifada. And then on Friday, we have part two coming out where he talks about some visions for a better world. Spoiler alert. It's communism. Also, I wanted to plug a couple of things for Giving Tuesday. I realize it's Thursday now, but I wasn't on the show on Tuesday. So one of them is a mutual aid center in Tijuana called El Comedor that's very near and dear to my heart. We did an episode of the Antifada where we interviewed some people there. I did a benefit show for them last year on Halloween when we could still have benefit shows. I'm going to put a link to that in the blog post. Donations may not be tax deductible because they're not a nonprofit, but you can be happy knowing that all of your money will go to things people need instead of the salaries of rich liberals' children. Also, we've got, I put a link in the blog post the other day, but I never talked about it. The Atlanta Solidarity Fund, because a number of activists have been arrested in recent weeks, including our friend Dick, who you may know from the Line Goes Down series on the Antifada. He's currently being held without bail in an ICE facility in Atlanta. So the Atlanta Solidarity Fund is doing great work helping him and other folks out. And I'm going to put a link to donate in the blog post.
All right. So folks can find that in the blog post and in the YouTube description as well. Those will be in there. Okay, folks, see these guys in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.